Yeah, so I'm going to read the first half of the story from 1 Samuel chapter 14, starting at verse 1. Page 283 in the Red Bibles. One day, Jonathan, son of Saul, said to his young armor bearer, "Come, let's go over to the Philistine outpost on the other side." But he did not tell his father. Saul was staying on the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree in Migron. With him were about 600 men, among whom was Ahijah, who was wearing an ephod. He was son of Ichabod's brother Ahitob, son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh. No one was aware that Jonathan had left. On each side of the pass that Jonathan intended to cross to reach the Philistine outpost was a cliff. One was called Bozez and the other Sene. One cliff stood to the north towards Michmash, the other to the south towards Geba. Jonathan said to his young armor bearer, "Come, let's go over to the outpost of those uncircumcised men. Perhaps the Lord will act on our behalf. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few." "Do all that you have in mind," his armor bearer said. "Go ahead. I am with you, heart and soul." Jonathan said, "Come on, then. We will cross over towards them and let them see us. If they say to us, 'Wait there until we come to you,' we will stay where we are and not go up to them. But if they say, 'Come up to us,' we will climb up, because that will be our sign that the Lord has given them into our hands." So both of them showed themselves to the Philistine outpost. "Look," said the Philistines, "the Hebrews are crawling out of the holes they were hiding in." The men of the outpost shouted to Jonathan and his armor bearer, "Come up to us and we'll teach you a lesson." So Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Climb up after me. The Lord has given them into the hand of Israel." Jonathan climbed up using his hands and feet, with his armor bearer right behind him. The Philistines fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer followed and killed behind him. In that first attack, Jonathan and his armor bearer killed some 20 men in an area of about half an acre. Then panic struck the whole army, those in the camp and field, and those in the outposts and raiding parties, and the ground shook. It was a panic sent by God. Saul's lookouts at Gibeah in Benjamin saw the army melting away in all directions. Then Saul said to the men who were with him, "Muster the forces and see who has left us." When they did, it was Jonathan and his armor bearer who were not there. Saul said to Ahijah, "Bring the Ark of God." At that time, it was with the Israelites. While Saul was talking to the priest, the tumult in the Philistine camp increased more and more. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." Then Saul and all his men assembled and went to the battle. They found the Philistines in total confusion, striking each other with their swords. Those Hebrews who had previously been with the Philistines and had gone up with them to their camp went over to the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. When all the Israelites who had hidden in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were on the run, they joined the battle in hot pursuit. So on that day, the Lord saved Israel, and the battle moved on beyond Beth Aven.
Now the Israelites were in distress that day because Saul had bound the people under an oath, saying, "Cursed be anyone who eats food before evening comes, before I have avenged myself on my enemies." So none of the troops tasted food. The entire army entered the woods, and there was honey on the ground. When they went into the woods, they saw the honey oozing out. Yet no one put his hand to his mouth, because they feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard that his father had bound the people with the oath, so he reached out to the end of the staff that was in his hand and dipped it into the honeycomb. He raised his hand to his mouth, and his eyes brightened. Then one of the soldiers told him, "Your father bound the army under a strict oath, saying, 'Cursed be anyone who eats food today.' That's why the men are faint." Jonathan said, "My father has made trouble for the country. See how my eyes brightened when I tasted a little of this honey. How much better it would have been if the men had eaten today some of the plunder they took from their enemies. Would not the slaughter of the Philistines have been even greater?" That day, after the Philistines had struck down, after the Israelites had struck down the Philistines from Michmash to Ahijon, they were exhausted. They pounced on the plunder, and taking sheep, cattle, and calves, they butchered them on the ground and ate them together with the blood. Then someone said to Saul, "Look, the men are sinning against the Lord by eating meat that has blood in it." "You have broken faith," he said. "Roll a large stone over here at once." Then he said, "Go out among the men and tell them, 'Each of you bring me your cattle and your sheep, and slaughter them here and eat them. Do not sin against the Lord by eating meat with blood still in it.'" So everyone brought his ox that night and slaughtered it there. Then Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first time he had done this. Saul said, "Let us go down and pursue the Philistines by night and plunder them till dawn, and let us not leave one of them alive." "Do whatever seems best to you," they replied. But the priest said, "Let us inquire of God here." So Saul asked God, "Shall I go down and pursue the Philistines? Will you give them into Israel's hand?" But God did not answer him that day. Saul therefore said, "Come here, all you who are leaders of the army, and let us find out what sin has been committed today. As surely as the Lord who rescues Israel lives, even if the guilt lies with my son Jonathan, he must die." But not one of them said a word. Saul then said to all the Israelites, "You stand over there. I and Jonathan, my son, will stand over here." "Do what seems best to you," they replied. Then Saul prayed to the Lord, the God of Israel, "Why have you not answered your servant today? If the fault is in me or my son Jonathan, respond with Urim. But if the men of Israel are at fault, respond with Thummim." Jonathan and Saul were taken by lot, and the men were cleared. Saul said, "Cast the lot between me and Jonathan, my son." And Jonathan was taken. Then Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what you've done." So Jonathan told him, "I tasted little honey with the end of my staff, and now I must die." Saul said, "May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if you do not die, Jonathan." But the men said to Saul, "Should Jonathan die, he who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel, never. As surely as the Lord lives, not a hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he did this today with God's help." So the men rescued Jonathan, and he was not put to death. Then Saul stopped pursuing the Philistines, and they withdrew to their own land. After Saul had assumed rule over Israel, he fought against the enemies on every side: Moab, the Ammonites, Edom, the kings of Zobah, and the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment on them. He fought valiantly and defeated the Amalekites, delivering Israel from the hands of those who had plundered them.
The Bible talks a lot about people, and it talks, one of the ways it describes people is that it describes them as sheep. We might think of famous phrases, "the Lord is my shepherd," implication, "I am a sheep." Or maybe Isaiah 53, "we all like sheep." Now, sheep are cute, right? That's the reason why we give our children fluffy lambs as cuddly toys. But when the Bible calls us sheep, they're not actually being particularly complimentary. Because the thing about sheep is that sheep are really stupid. They're easily deceived and quickly led astray. And the trouble is that we all are too, just like that woman on the video. She's led really quickly into a totally bizarre and unexplained pattern of behaviour just because everybody else is doing it. And she is not untypical of all of us. That's why we got this particular headline recently from about a week ago. That big tanker there has cement in it. It's taking it to a building site, and apparently had a train of about 20 cars following behind it because people thought it was a petrol lorry. And apparently they got very cross when he realised he had this big tail behind him and he couldn't quite understand why they were following him. But it's not just in little things. We are all in danger of being like sheep and following people. We're all in danger of following the wrong type of people as well. We're all at risk of leaders who aren't any good for us. It's the reason why there will never cease to be charlatans and hucksters and fraudsters and whatever other phrase you want to describe people who will try and lead people astray. Because we are all like sheep. And we are all in danger of following the wrong people, following the wrong pressure, just like the woman in the video. And this can lead us into real danger. Because more often than not, there's more than just our money at risk. If we follow the wrong church leader or the wrong people in society, the wrong religious leaders, it's our very souls that are in danger. But don't fear, because the Bible does have something to say about this. And that's exactly the problem that the Israelites are facing in 1 Samuel. If you've been with us over the last few weeks, back in chapter 8, the Israelites had rejected having God as their king and instead said these words, "We want a king over us. Then we should be like the other nations." Does that sound familiar? "With a king to lead us and to go out before us and fight our battles." Bah! They're being like sheep, aren't they? They're following the other nations. They'd wanted to conform to what everyone else is doing. The problem is, as we saw last time, they've got the wrong sort of king. They've got the wrong person to lead them. They're following Saul, who will lead them away from God rather than towards God. And as we go through chapter 14, we see in more detail what this looks like. Now, there's a lot to cover, so we'll cover this quite a sort of big picture stuff. There's more detail that we could go into, but there's three bits that I want to draw out. The first thing we see is the sort of leader we need. When we left the Israelites at the end of last week, they were in big trouble. They were an army of 600 men armed with two swords and a bunch of gardening equipment, standing against an army as numerous as the sand on the seashore. It's not great odds, is it? Not only that, we've also learned that Saul isn't following God's way or his plan for people. And so he'll be deposed as a result. God has already told him he is not going to be king any longer. It's a whole lot of bad news. And so as our story starts in chapter 14, we get a split. We start to see two different storylines diverging. And so we get Saul. You see him in verse 2. He's on the outskirts of Gibeah. It's the town that he's from. And he's under a pomegranate tree, which is nice for him. But in a crisis, he is a picture of inaction. He's just kind of sat there. Whether he's resting or hiding, it doesn't really matter. He's not seeking the Lord. He's not fulfilling what God has called him to do. He is just sat there. In contrast to that, we meet Jonathan. You meet him in verse 1, and then verses 1 to 14 are mostly about Jonathan. He's Saul's son. And actually, at the start of chapter 13, the previous chapter, he's the one who started off this whole conflict with the Philistines that we're dealing with now. He's up to his old tricks, and he wants to target another Philistine outpost. So he and his armor bearer sneak across the valley and attack and defeat the Philistine outpost at Michmash. It's a remarkable story of two men overcoming a garrison 10 times their size, as verse 14 says over the page. But I think the reason we get to read this story in the Bible is not because of the victory in and of itself, but the manner of the victory, the way that Jonathan wins it, because he stands in marked contrast to his father. Saul, in the previous chapter, saw his army slipping away and so decided to take matters into his own hands, offering the sacrifices in a way that he wasn't supposed to, showing that he doesn't trust God's ability to win the battle. But look at verse 6. Look at how much of a contrast this is. So, halfway through, perhaps the Lord will act on our behalf. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few. Do you see the contrast? Saul doesn't trust God's ability to save him, but Jonathan does. He understands who he's dealing with. Jonathan sees that God is the God of the whole universe, the one in control of every moment. And he knows that God is the one who grants victories or brings defeat. God is the one who is sovereign, the one who rules and decides. And if God grants the victory, well, then it doesn't matter if you have 2 soldiers or 2 million. Victory is coming your way. The writer of 1 Samuel is, I think, deliberately setting Jonathan and Saul up against each other. One is a failed king. The other is the sort of leader that we need. One who will lead people to truly trust God. One who will say, God is good and God is in control, and so whatever happens, I will trust and follow his ways. Because God is good and God is in control, and he will do good things, even if I don't understand the whole picture. And so the question we should ask is, well, who are we following? Who are we following? Are we following the right sort of leader? Are they ones who are going to point us towards God? Or are they going to point us another way, away from God? Now, this might be true of the people we look to, other people around us, and our friends, our teachers, our heroes. Are they helping us point towards God? But it's also true of the Lord Jesus. It's a question of whether we're looking towards the Lord Jesus or not. Because no matter how great someone is at trusting God and following his ways, Jesus is better. And so however much we may look to people to show us the way to go, Jesus is better. He is the one that we should follow. Because he trusted God completely. He knew that the Lord could save, whether by many or by few, and even through death itself. That he could die on a cross for the sins of the world and know that God was still good and God was in control. Jonathan points towards that kind of leader, the sort of leader that we need. Now, the whole question of trusting God revolves around what we think God is like. Is he good? Will he defend us from danger? Is he strong enough to be able to save us from our enemies? Because if God has no power, then there's no point in following God. Because however good and perfect and holy and moral he is, if he has no power, there's no point in following him. If he's not interested in defending us from danger, well, then we can't bring our troubles to him. If he isn't good, well, then there's no point in asking him to fix the world. Saul doesn't trust God. He doesn't believe that he doesn't believe those things, and so God won't bless him as a leader. But Jonathan does. And through verses 15 to 23, Jonathan is rewarded with a great victory. You look at verse 15 and the very end of the verse, panic breaks out. It's a panic sent by God. God is in control. God is able to save. God had been intending to rescue his people just as he promised. But again, we see trouble with Saul's leadership. He pops back into the picture again in verse 17. He doesn't immediately decide to capitalize on what God has done. No, he decides to call a register. Right, who's here? Okay, who are we missing? Because it's all a bit weird. What is he doing? Then he decides to bring up the Ark of God. Now, this is a symbol of God being with his people. In other parts of 1 Samuel, we see them taking the Ark of God into battle with them. It's their sort of their standard, their flag. But he can't decide whether to get Ahijah the priest to offer sacrifices or not. That's why he says at the end of verse 19, withdraw your hand, that's he's going to have been offering the sacrifices. And he's just being really indecisive. He's not sure what to do. But then finally, in verse 20, then Saul and all his army assembled, and they went into battle. Now, it's a wonderful moment. God's people are freed from the Philistine oppression. Not by their own strength or the power of their leader. As Frank highlighted earlier, those words in verse 23. So on that day, Saul didn't save Israel. The Lord saved Israel. What actually had the soldiers done? Well, nothing really. They've just mopped up after the work that God had done already. I guess it's a bit like going out for a meal. If you go to a restaurant, you're not expected to decide what you want and then, you know, roll your sleeves up, put on the apron over your nice dress or shirt and then head into the kitchen. You're not expected to prepare your own meal, slave over the food and then finally serve yourself. No. It's ridiculous, isn't it? One of the lovely things about going out for a meal is that somebody goes out and buys the ingredients, prepares the meal, prepares the menu, serves, prepares the food, and then cleans up afterwards. All you and I have to do is sit and enjoy what's been prepared for us. And that's the difference between Saul's expectation and Jonathan's expectations, I think. Saul is expecting to have to get into the kitchen and do the hard work. Jonathan is enjoying what God has done for him. But what about us? What are our expectations of God? Are we expecting to have to do some hard work for God? Are we expecting to have to work hard to get into heaven? Because if that's what you're thinking, then I've got great news for you. Because you don't have to. You can put down the metaphorical frying pan and get out of the kitchen. Because God has won a great victory for us too. Not over the Philistines, but over sin and death. At the cross, Jesus defeated those things and won a powerful, wonderful victory for us. So we don't have to struggle and strain and fight to defeat the power of sin ourselves. No, Jesus has done that for us. So again, don't look anywhere else. Look to him. Don't look to other ways or other people. Look to Jesus. Because God has won a victory for you through him. Now, if we were to stop our passage for today at verse 23 and not read any more of 1 Samuel, or chapter 14 specifically, I guess we might think this had a kind of pretty positive ending. Yeah, it didn't start great, but ultimately it worked out okay in the end. But that's not the full story of this chapter. And as an aside, it's why you should never skip over bits in the Bible. It's there so that we read all of it and see the full picture. Because the rest of the passage serves as a cautionary tale. It's a tale not of two cities, but of three oaths. And these three oaths, these three proclamations that Saul makes show why he is not up to the task of being Israel's leader and why he's a warning for us all. So firstly, we see Saul's foolish oath concerning food in verse 24. Cursed be anyone who eats food before evening comes, before I have avenged myself on my enemies. In passing, just note myself and my enemies. For Saul, this isn't God's enemies or God's victory. It's about him. But back to the oath. This is a foolish oath for a number of reasons. You know, it weakens the army as they chase the Philistines. They reach the point of exhaustion. Look at how Jonathan describes it in verse 29. My father has made trouble for the country. In the moment of God's victory, Saul is undermining it. It limits how much the people of God are able to enjoy God's blessing, what he's won for them. Not only that, it leads them to doing the wrong thing. In verse 31 to 33, the Israelites pounce, these hungry soldiers pounce on the enemy cattle and slaughter them and eat them. The problem is that they are so hungry that they just get on with it and they break one of the fundamental commands of being the people of God, which is that that God says to people, you should not eat food with the blood still in it. If you're interested, why, ask me afterwards. Saul's foolishness, his poor leadership, leads the whole nation into sinning, into doing the wrong thing, so that they break a far greater command. And the irony is that when the Israelites do this, Saul turns on them and says in verse 33, the start of the new paragraph, you've broken faith, you foolish Israelites. You guys are doing the wrong thing because they've been set up for failure. But it doesn't stop there. Saul wants to carry on the pursuit, but the priest tells him to inquire of the Lord. Good decision, we think. When he doesn't hear anything from God, Saul investigates why. Because his oath has been broken. So Saul gets really mad. Someone's going to be in big, even fatal trouble. So that's oath number two in verse 39. So they work out who has broken the promise, Saul's oath. It's Jonathan, his own son. And so Saul gives another oath in verse 34. May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if you do not die, Jonathan. Listen to him. Saul is threatening to kill his own son just so that his word doesn't get broken. Now, thankfully, God is rescued by the rest of the Israelites. But what a fool. Saul shows himself for what he really is, a foolish leader. He looks impressive. He looked like he was just the right sort of thing. But in that moment, when his character came to the surface, he reveals himself to be a disaster. There's more we can say. There's kind of odd and unusual bits, which feel free to ask me afterwards. But as we look back at the passage as a whole, I hope you see that we have to be really careful who we're following. Because Saul looked great. He looked really impressive, but he didn't have the right character for the job. When the chips were down, when things are starting to go wrong, he not only endangers himself, but he leads other people away from God. He can't do it. He can't point people towards God and leads others away too. And that, I think, is the danger for all of us. And I think it's a danger that's in two parts. There's a danger of following poor human leaders, church leaders, movement leaders, politicians, you name it. So be careful. Where are they leading you? Are they helping you towards following God? Because if they're not, don't follow them. They've got to go. Be careful. Even be careful of me, the rest of the leadership team here. And we trust, Lord willing, that we're teaching the Bible faithfully, but don't just trust blindly that we will carry on doing the same thing. We are weak, feeble human beings, all of us. But there's a bigger question of leadership too. Because Saul isn't just an example of a human leader. He is God's appointed leader of God's chosen people. And his failure points to the failure of every human leader, the way that none of us are up to the task. If you were to read on through the rest of 1 and 2 Samuel, through 1 and 2 Kings that come afterwards, you'll see the constant failure of humanity to lead God's people well. And that's true not because they're terrible leaders, but just because that's true of all of humanity. None of us are able to lead God's people well. We are all sinners. None of us are able to truly point to God with all of our lives, and so we are in need of rescue. If we just follow human leaders, we are doomed. And that's true of any of us, no matter what system or religion we profess. But there is another way. Look to Jesus Christ instead. Look to him and trust him. He doesn't share our weakness, our propensity to sin and turn away from God. So I was reading my Bible earlier in the week. I came across these words. And I think they're a great comfort to us. Jesus says in John 17, I have made you, God, known to them. That's all believers. And I will continue to make you known in order that the love you have for me may be in them and that I myself may be in them. Jesus' prayer and passion is to see all of us kept safe in the knowledge of God. If you were to read the rest of John 17, you'll see his desire and passion and prayer to see all believers kept safe in God. And he assures it because he will continue to make God known to us all. He's the opposite of the leader who lets us down. He won't go and make stupid oaths or promises. He is the leader who gave up everything to raise us up. He is the leader we need. So don't trust me to save you. Don't trust someone else. Look to Jesus.